Hey everybody, welcome to Beyond the Matrix with Patricia Corey. It's the radio program that invites you, it dares you to think out the box. Okay, I'm all tongue-tied tonight. I don't know what's happening. Must be because I have jet lag having just come back from Montreal. Let me try that again. The program that dares you to think outside the box of convention and flow in the free thought zone where all is possible. And I've got an outstanding guest to help us do that today. But before I get to him, I just want to make a couple of announcements. First of all, to all of my incredible family of light in Montreal who embraced me and welcomed me, 700 people at my lecture, je vous aime, je vous pense, et merci à vous. That's about as much French as I can do, but my heart is in it. And a reminder that we'll be talking about Egypt tonight, so please remember that the Egypt trip is filling fast, January 14th to 24. And if you want information and you want to get on this trip, don't procrastinate, okay? So you go to info@syrianrevelations.net and get on a trip of a lifetime, as people will attest to the other ones who have been with me in the magic land of Egypt. And who better to talk about Egypt and all of its mysticism than my guest tonight. His name is Edward Malkowski. He's the author of a number of books, but the one that captured my attention is his new book. It's called The Spiritual Technology of Ancient Egypt. His website is sonsofgod-daughtersofmen.com. I'm going to ask him, for all you feminists out there, to explain such a title. Ed, are you with me?
I sure am. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you, and I hear you really well, so that is good, because you are where?
I'm in Champaign, Illinois.
Okay, and I'm in Rome, and the radio station's in California, so how's that for high tech?
Yeah, so we're halfway around the world from each other, aren't we?
Well, we'll be talking about spiritual technology, so we're right in the power zone here, as far as subject matter goes, being able to link all around the world like this. There is good in technology.
There certainly is.
So, Ed, I'd like to start the interview. Would you give us a little background about you? Because you've got such a scientific background, and you're doing such spiritual work, and I feel that this is the quintessence of what we're supposed to be doing on the planet now, blending science and spirit. So how did you come to get involved in such a monumental task as writing the kinds of scholarly works that you do?
Well, it's a search for truth is really what it is. It started a long, long time ago, probably about the age of eight, when most people and I became aware of my own internal thought life. You know, it's the same questions that we all ask: who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I me, and why am I not somebody else?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, not everybody here is asking those questions, but should
well, that's
be.
That's true. That's true. But for some reason, I just had this thirst inside of me to know, you know, why we're here, what are we doing? And it happened very, very young. And about that same time, I became interested in history. My dad started bringing home magazines about Marshall Cavendish's History of World War II. And I was fascinated by history, by what went on a long time ago. And that stayed with me. And in junior high, I delved into U.S. history, and particularly the Civil War. And in college, I delved more into U.S. history, a little bit of ancient history. And since then, it's been part of my passion to know what really happened way back when. How did civilization start? As far as the scientific part of it goes, I'm not really a scientist, but I'm also a lover of science, because science really is also a search for truth. You kind of wouldn't know that by today's paradigm police, how they, you know, think a certain way, and you can't think.
Well, I try to honor the free scientists that are doing the brilliant work of breaking through the constraints.
That's correct.
But, yeah, we do.
And they are out there. One off the top of my head is Bruce Lipton's doing some great work. and there's a few others. But what's really, really interesting from my point of view is some of the first highly spiritualistic scientists were the creators of quantum physics. Erwin Schrödinger, Werner Heisenberg, and Niels Bohr. These three men, there were others, but these three men were very instrumental in creating quantum physics back in the 20s and 30s. And each one of them went on to write highly philosophical books and to state that, you know, there is only one mind, there's only one entity, and we are all part of it. So it's a really interesting mix.
But you have such a profound knowledge of quantum physics. To hear you say that you're not scientific or you're not a scientist is mind-boggling.
Well, I think of myself as being a scientist, but from the academic, you know, standpoint, I would not be considered a scientist. Science is
well,
really
that's good.
Just,
that just, keeps you in the free thinking zone, right?
Right, right. Science is nothing more than a search for truth, and trying mm-hmm. to be objective about it. And why I say objective is because there really is no such thing as objectivity. How traditional science creates objectivity is what they do is they limit the scope of their study. And that creates what I call limited objectivity. But
if I can interject something, it also creates funded objectivity, if you get my sarcastic drift.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. I have two boys that are in college right now. One is in a PhD program in neuroscience. The other is a theoretical physicist as an undergrad. And
well,
funding.
Congratulations.
Thank you. If funding and politics is, well, that's the name of the game right there.
And science.
Yep.
They'll
correct.
Get smooshed into a big ball of questionable activity. All right, I'll stop being sarcastic and we'll stick to the pureness of what you're bringing through, because I certainly don't mean to poo-poo at all. And I do, you know, constantly refer to the fact that the free scientists are out there breaking through the paradigms and creating all kinds of wonderful new ways for us to embrace what we're headed toward.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there is so much in this book. It is a real task for an interviewer to find a thread that will take us through some of the main concepts. So I'm going to put that on you and ask you, can you give us basically, I love the subtitle, Sacred Science and the Mystery of Consciousness, which, of course, is what I'm all about. That's my mission in life, is to just scratch the surface of all of this. But I'd like to ask you if you can kind of, you know, give us an idea of what inspired you to write the book, and what is your theme here? What is the thread that binds it together?
Well, two men inspired me to write the book. The first one is John Anthony West. I'm sure you've heard of him.
Oh, yes. And, great work.
And another one is a man by the name of René Schwaller-de-Lubitz, who John is also a devotee of. Schwaller-de-Lubitz was a philosopher that lived during the early and middle part of the 20th century.
And he gave us the fabulous Temple of Man.
That's correct.
Sacred Geometry imprinted on the temple at Luxor, yes.
That's correct. And he wrote a whole other bunch of books, Esoterium and Symbolism, Symbol and Symbolique, The Egyptian Miracle, and on and on and on. But what he found in Egypt made everything for me really come together. And what I mean by come together is my own religious upbringing, as well as the scientific world, as well as my questions about history and where civilization came from. And how Schwaller did that is he showed that the ancient Egyptians understood metaphysical concepts that are akin to today's new philosophy that has coming out of quantum physics. So that really struck me. How did these people so long ago understand the same principles that we do today that's coming out of quantum physics? Well, there's two answers. One, they just kind of lucked out and kind of guessed correctly. Or they had some kind of program, study, technology, some sort of educational system, a meditational system that they had been practicing for a very long time.
And can I interject another one?
Sure. Go right ahead.
Or this was a civilization that, as you said, was evolved in this wisdom and perhaps had outside assistance.
That's a possibility, too.
Because, you know, obviously we've got just a huge, huge spike, at least from the history, from what we can put together from the scattered bits. We have this enormous spike at the onset of the Egyptian civilization.
Yeah, that's civilization kind of appears out of nowhere. As far
although
as
I know that you knew Hakim, I'm sure.
Yes,
who passed?
He passed away.
You didn't know?
No, I did not know that.
Yes, he passed on the 23rd of August. I had Stephen Mailer on. We had a tribute to him. Kind of a hard moment, but I know he's listening, keeping us straight on the facts. So in his honor, I want to say that he does not like, because I don't think of ever think of him in the past, he does not like the concept that Egypt came out of nowhere and reminds us of the Comitians and the civilizations of the 42 tribes of Africa.
Oh, absolutely. I don't believe for a minute that we just simply came out of nowhere. But from an evidential standpoint, when you look back into history, it appears that we came out of nowhere, which is obviously not correct. We came from somewhere. We got here somehow. You know, something happened.
But the thing is, we've got the books are so that were burned, so we don't really know what was. I mean, the pre-written information. We just don't have our hands on. Doesn't mean it wasn't there, yeah?
Right. What I think happened, I agree with Hakim. Also John Anthony West agrees with this timeline, too, that the origins of Egyptian civilization goes way, 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 way back in history, tens of thousands of years, even into, you know, the 40,000, 50,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
so do
I. What I think happened, and I think the evidence really points to this too, is that around the time of the end of the Ice Age, here we're talking about, you know, 10,000, 12,000 BC, there was obviously a global calamity. This is fact because we know that a vast majority of the species died off, and the species that survived was a small part of that. And
yes.
Those species suffered through a calamity. That's pretty obvious, particularly from places like the Brea Tar Pits in California. There's places in Alaska. There's places, I just visited one in South Dakota, a mammoth pit, just this past summer. So we know there was a terrible catastrophe. And if man was alive, which of course he was, then he also succumbed to this catastrophe. But
coincides perfectly with the Atlantis theory of
exactly, the, exactly,
which I do subscribe to. I have to admit.
Yes, I think people keep looking for Atlantis as this island or this city or something like that. I think Atlantis was the entire civilization.
I think it was an entire continent as well.
Yes.
Don't you?
Well,
I journey as probably as much as you do. And being back and forth in the Maya lands, I'm just back from Peru and Egypt, and, you know, you see all this recurring history and similarities, and if you've got a continent right in the middle of the Atlantic, you've got access. So I really do perceive Atlantis of extending from all the way up to Greenland, perhaps, all the way down to South America, which would explain so much.
Yeah, I think one guy was putting the center of it in the middle of the Atlantic, not terribly far from the Caribbean islands. I think that's one. I can't remember the guy's name. But yeah.
Oh, is that? Well, the thing is that I don't prescribe to the idea of just an island because I think that the impact of the civilization was so vast, and I think that it provided access. If you imagine a short expanse of, well, short is not the right word, a not too distant expanse of ocean between this gigantic continent, which would correspond with the North Atlantic Ridge,
mm-hmm.
and South America, the Caribbean, Egypt, Africa, it would be very much more easy to explain why the exact same myths, the exact same belief systems, even artifacts are found on both sides.
Right. That's absolutely right. And actually, it even goes as far east, from what I know of, as into Iran. There's a river there that flooded in a bunch of graves and artifacts made of stone. Beautiful vases and pictures made of stone were brought up to the surface. And the police in Iran had a very hard time about it because people were stealing these artifacts and trying to sell them. So there was this whole scheme of trying to keep all this stuff together. But yeah, I agree. This whole area from South America all the way to the Nile Valley and to Iran was a huge civilization long, long, long ago that was decimated by the catastrophe at 10,000 BC. Now, from my perspective, based on the evidence between right now and, 9,000 years ago, I think what happened is a major percentage of the population was killed off, and possibly down to, maybe 5,000 individuals, 20,000 individuals, something really low. Because you see what's happening from 9,000 BC to 3,000 BC is civilization is slowly building itself up. You have things springing
exactly.
up. In Turkey, there's Cattle Hurric, there's Jericho, and this is going on all over the world, too. It's going on over in South America. About 3,000 BC, you have a corral springing up. So, some of these artifacts that we look at, particularly the pyramids and some of the statues, and the same thing with over in South America, these things weren't built 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. They were built more like, 10 or 20 or 30,000 years ago.
Yeah, well, Hakim puts the date of the Osirian and the Sphinx at 50,000 BC.
That would probably fit well with the erosion on it. In my second book, Before the Pharaohs, I did a lot of work with Robert Schock's work on the dating of the Sphinx, and in a book that I have coming out next year, which is yet to be published. It's kind of a version 2 of that book. Right now I'm calling it Before the Pharaoh, Civilization X. I've been looking at academic papers written about erosion in different areas of the world, and I'm finding out that the Sphinx is extremely old, and Hakim may very well be right, and it's scientific to actually prove that so. So it's a very interesting thought to think that.
Now, have you been wandering around under the artifacts in Giza where they say there are no tunnels?
I have never been down there. I've been down a few holes, but that's closely guarded area there, and I don't have the political muster to actually, get Zahi Hawass to take me in there or anything like that.
Yeah, well, they say that officially there are no tunnels, even though the Giza Plateau's ancient name is Ras Tal, the city of tunnels.
Oh, there's tunnels there. We all know there's tunnels there.
Yeah, but oh, how to get into them. This is the question.
Yeah, that's the real hard part. What's really interesting about these tunnels, and this is coming out in my next book, too, there's a man living up in Washington. He's a marine engineer. He's actually back engineered the lower part of the Great Pyramid at Giza and has pretty much scientifically proven that the subterranean portion of the Giza, the Great Pyramid on Giza, was a water pump. It's a ram-style water pump that we stopped using here in our civilization a couple hundred years ago because of electricity. But
okay, can you elaborate on this? Because I know you talk about it in the book, and I think this is really exciting information.
Well, the Giza Pyramid is really a very mysterious structure, okay? It's probably the most bizarre ancient building ever built. There's a subterranean area, and there's a middle chamber, and then there's an uppermost chamber that's all made of granite. And of course, we all know that the academians say that it's a tomb well, you know,
sure.
it's not a tomb. Chris Dunn made a huge breakthrough 10 years ago or so, and he really looked at it hard from a manufacturing point of view, from an engineer's point of view, and said, hey, you know what? This thing looks like it's a power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the machining and the way everything was put together, you know, it's extremely plausible that it really was a power plant. But the subterranean area was kind of a mystery, because the room down there appeared to be unfinished. It was really rough. And actually, John Cadman, about the same time that Chris was publishing the Giza Power Plant, John Cadman was making models of the subterranean chamber, trying to see if it was in fact a water pump. He got his ideas from a man named Kunkel, who thought the entire pyramid was a water pump. Well, that's not the case. The water pump beneath the pyramid was designed, Cadman found out, for a very specific reason. And that reason was to create a shock wave from the pumping action going back and forth. It's called a compression wave. A compression wave that actually moves up the center of the pyramid. Well, why does it do that? Well, the top chamber is made of granite, and granite is probably the best material you can use for sound. Today, a lot of high-fidelity stereo companies use granite to base their equipment with and base their speakers with, because granite has a certain resonance to it that no other material in the world has. So, for me, what looks like going on is this water pump is creating this compression wave, and it's moving through the pyramid up to the top chamber, and through the Grand Gallery. As it moves there, it's being turned into sound through Helmholtz resonators and creating two notes that are going out the north and the south shaft of the King's Chamber. Well, why are they doing that? Well, recent studies show a couple of scientists in Russia, physicists, who are actually trying to figure out what pressure waves in the sky would do. And they have found out that the pressure waves, which is the same thing as a musical note, a sound is pressure, is vibrations. What they found out is that would create an electrical field up above in the sky. So, I mean, this is really wild, okay? But
no, it's really not, considering HARP and everything the government's doing today.
Well, good, that's correct. Good, it's. And by the way, I had my theoretical physicist son work with this theory through me over the last year. So we really thought this out, and I've made sure by him that it's physically plausible. Anyway, so we have this bubble of sorts created, this electrical field created around the top of the pyramid. Well, why aren't they going to do that? Why would you want to do that? Well, one very interesting thing is this bubble of energy would do one thing that we know of. It would deflect extremely low and very low frequencies that are everywhere around our atmosphere and focus them down to the ground in various areas. But why would they want to do that? Well, and this is even more interesting. It's some late research, too, that plants are very sensitive to very low and extremely low frequencies. And studies have shown that if you subject plants to these frequencies, they actually like it and actually grow better. They grow faster and stronger and have a higher yield on their grain.
That's fascinating. And I wonder if you're going to start to say something about Agartha and the possibility that these waves are being sent into this inner earth to serve possible life forms within the planet. Is that too far up?
I have no idea about that.
I mean, we're going far out. Let's go for the gusto.
You mean life forms living within the earth and in the hollow earth or what?
Yeah, why not? We know that they're living at I don't know how many miles down, because every major city and every major government has a network of hospital environments for them. So it's really not that far-fetched to imagine that there are civilizations underground.
I guess that could be possible. This kind of explains why the pyramids are in a line north and south west of the Nile River. You have the engine up at the top, which is the Great Pyramid, and it is creating this resonance field of electricity, and the sound coming out of it is moving in all directions, and the large pyramids to the south of Giza are picking up this resonance and creating their own resonance bubbles of electricity and, fertilizing all the fields up and down the Nile. Actually, if you really think about it, there needs to be a reason for any civilization to build such huge things like these pyramids. They can be akin to our power plants. I think it's a pretty good equal for
what? I'm sorry?
So
I didn't get what you just said. They could be equivalent to what?
They could be equivalent to our own power plants in a certain idealistic way. I mean, we don't use our power plants to fertilize fields, but power plants are
expensive. No, we use them to destroy them.
Yeah, we use them to destroy them. But,
and this is the evolution of man. But
power plants
do you also, I'm sure you will talk about the fact that, or at least consider, that very possibly there are far more metaphysical purposes for the use of these sound waves, because we have seen the pyramid pinpointed as the epicenter of the platonic solid, which we'll get into in a minute, that is the earth, the icosahedral forms of the earth.
Yes, can we
consider also that that this could be some form of activator for the entire earth grid lines, earth power lines?
I don't know if it would work for the entire earth, but it certainly would work for that area up and down the Nile Valley. And actually, this has kind of been proven true. People that suffer from depression, it occurs usually when sandstorms come. This is typical of the Middle East, of Egypt and Israel and that area. When sandstorms come in from the west, the friction of the sands rubbing together ionizes the atmosphere, and this seems to make people that have problems with depression get even more depressed. And they found out that reversing that polarity in the atmosphere actually makes people feel better. So it's quite plausible that a secondary use of it, and it could be the primary for that matter, would be to create a sort of area that makes people feel good and happy. It's possible.
Well, it sure is a monumental endeavor to do that.
Right. So whatever the purpose was, for this civilization to spend so many resources to build these pyramids up and down the Nile Valley, they had to have a very, very good reason. There's just no question.
Now, I interrupted you earlier on, and I'm glad I did, because you shared all of this wonderful information with us. You were talking about somebody backdropping the I can't remember what you said, someone that you know is working on the RAM.
Yes,
water
John
pump.
Cadman, yes.
Yeah, did you finish that thought? Because I think we interjected something in the middle of that.
Yeah, I went back to it. That's kind of the engine behind the sound waves that are coming out of the top of the pyramid. That creates.
And what is his proof that you said has come out from his work?
He's actually modeled the subterranean chamber.
There, that's what I want to get back
to. Yeah, I mean, he actually sat down and built models. He built three or four different models, and he tested this and really kind of proved it. He also proved that there has to be tunnels underneath the Giza Plateau.
How did he prove that?
By this water pump. It's a logic. The proof of his model.
This is very exciting information.
The proof of his model, which, can be tested and replicated by anyone that wants to do it. That is pure scientific from an academic point of view.
Okay.
Now, can you give us his name again and maybe a website or a way to research what he's up to?
Sure. His name is John Cadman, and his website is, I'll go to it right here in just a second.
All right, well, while you're getting his website, I'm reminding everyone, if you're just turning in now, which is a bummer, you've missed a half an hour of Edward Malkowski. He's the author of just a phenomenal book, and not the only of his of works. It's called The Spiritual Technology of Ancient Egypt, Sacred Science, and the Mystery of Consciousness. And his website is www.sonsofgod-daughtersofmen.com. And, okay, you're going to give us the website of this gentleman.
Yeah, I've actually updated my website recently, and it's edwardfmalkowski.com, too.
Oh, I'm so glad, because I'm that's so much
easier. A lot
easier,
isn't it?
Yeah. All right, so now it's
edwardfmalkowski.com. Yeah. Sons of God, Daughters of Men was my first book. So the
I haven't read that one.
So the original website was sonsofgoddaughtersofmen.com. But then after I was done writing my second book, I thought, well, you know, that doesn't fit well anymore because I've got two books. So and then I had three books, and I thought, well, I better change it. So I did. Anyway, John Cadman's website is www.greatpyramidgizapulsepump.com. And there's a bunch of hyphens there. So it's great-pyramid-giza-pulse-pyramid.com.
That's kind of tricky.
So
if you didn't get all that, you can just search John Cadman.
Correct.
Yeah?
John Cadman, okay. Engineering Science, Great Pyramid, and you'll come to his website. Anyway.
Well, I have to say, having spent some mystical hours down there in that subterranean chamber, that you can feel these waves of energy coming through your body. Have you spent a lot of time there?
No, I never got to go down there. Well,
no?
Last year, no. When I was there last year, everything was closed off. And you couldn't even.
You've got to have some context in the right places.
Yeah, I know. I want to go back. It's awesome being there.
Well, maybe you can be there when I'm there, and somehow we can incorporate some, because I bring groups all the time, as I mentioned earlier in the show, and maybe, who knows, well, you could give some of your wisdom to the group. We'll work it out.
Okay.
But if you want to get into the subterranean chamber, this I can do for you.
Oh, how did you get in there?
I bring my groups in there.
Okay, so who did you contact on the plateau to get you down there?
I have friends in high places.
You got friends? I knew it.
Well, I'm not sure if it's I've got friends in high places or they simply haven't found me out yet, if you get the drift.
Right, well, speaking of that, the second time I was at Giza on the Sphinx, I was taking pictures of the erosion around the Sphinx, and this man walked up to me, and he just started talking to me nicely. Hey, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And he wasn't hassling me like he was trying to sell me something. And so I started talking to him. And then he said, would you like a tour? And I said,
Oop.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, he pulled out his card. He pulled out his card and he said, I am with the, you know, Antiquities Council, whatever the appropriate name is. And I looked at his card and I said, sure. Oh, my God. He took me places that was behind barbed wire, behind fences, armed by guards. It was great. And he took me to a spot that I have never heard about and never read about, I don't know, 100 or 200 yards west of the Sphinx. Toward the south, there is the remains of an unknown temple. And it's kind of like a rock shelter, all right? You have this rock shelter that's about 30 or 40 feet deep by roughly 60, 80 feet wide. And there's three remnants of granite pillars that have been fluted on the sides and have hieroglyphics on them. And then if you look back into the rock shelter, it goes into a cave area, and there's a huge yellow iron gate that's locked so no one else can get in there. But for me, that was just awesome because I've never heard about it, never read about it. No one knows nothing about it, and there it is, plain as day. I took a whole bunch of pictures, too. It was absolutely
Well, great. Something similar happened to me as well. In fact, it might be the same person, but we won't name him on the show, who said, what is it that you're really looking for with this, you know, deep looks, soulful looks into my eyes? And I said, everything that I'm not supposed to see. And he said, okay. And I said,
yeah.
But I do have one thing in mind, which is the Osiris shaft. Have you been
yes.
in there?
I have not been
Did you go
in
all
there.
The way down?
No, I haven't gone all the way down. I know about it. I've seen pictures of it. It's that was created a very, 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 very long time ago. Very long time ago.
Well, I want you to know that I got permission to go down. So I went down. You know, it's there's okay, first of all, for the people that are listening, it's called the Osiris Shaft because at the bottom of this 30-meter-long, straight-down, very scary shaft has been found a so-called tomb, which is another sarcophagus-type structure with four broken pillars around it, which is very exciting. To me, it's some sort of a battery, some kind of an electromagnetic device or structure. And I've read an account of this area where the person who has gone down said the water is like acid. Have you heard this?
I haven't heard the acid part. Go ahead.
He said, a writer that went down there, that the rocks were crumbling at his feet and falling in, and he could hear them sizzling in the water.
Ooh.
Which led him to believe that if he put his foot in it, it would be a real drag.
Wow, yeah.
But that it had some sort of, you know, an acidic nature, and I thought, well, there you go. You've got some huge battery network around the pyramid.
Yeah, there was like...
Very exciting.
There were three granite sarcophagi in there, too, wasn't there?
Yes, there are two at the second level, apparently, and then there's one, the big one at the bottom. And then the person that went down there said that there appear to be tunnel areas that are full of debris and closed off. So I, little Pat, am determined to get down. So I got as far as the first level and went, you know, this is really crazy. I mean, one slip of the foot here and you are, you know, history. So this man who helped me go there said, I said, look, can you do this where I've got some serious hikers, chains and ropes and what are they called? You know how hikers use all those devices?
Repelling rope.
Yeah, that'll do. And I said, that bears a lot of weight because I'm no lightweight. I need to be sure that I can get out of there. But I am determined to go down there. And I know, or I intuit, that there are tunnels leading from the Sphinx, from the pyramid, and crossing through that area because the guy that went down said there were a few areas that looked like they had been deliberately filled with debris to hide the fact that there were tunnels. So when this wonderful guy from the Antiquities Department brought me there, I said, isn't there an easier way to get here? And he looked at me mysteriously, and he said, we have never declared that there are tunnels under the plateau.
Have you ever heard of a fourth pyramid on Giza?
Yes.
That is a very, very interesting concept because...
Are you going to share that with us?
Yes, I am a little bit. Obviously, it's not there anymore. But being the lover of history that I am, there's a certain disconnect between our modern history and the history of ancient times. I think a man by the name of Martin Burnell, in his trilogy books called Black Athena, does a very good job of describing what happened to the history of the ancients versus the history of us modern folks and how it got all messed up. Anyway, back to the fourth pyramid. The history coming out of the Arabs in, you know, the 9th and 10th, 12th century, that area, the history coming out of there paints a very, very different picture of Giza. One historian, one Arab historian, wrote that the remains, the granite debris and remains of the city around Giza lasted for a half day's walk in each direction. Now,
wow.
That's a pretty big city. So I wonder what is underneath the sands there. And also, there's writings of a fourth pyramid on Giza. And they call it the Black Pyramid because it was either built out of a black marble or black granite. And it was a smaller pyramid than any of the three pyramids in a row, but that they put in it machines and instruments of their civilization, almost as if they knew this catastrophe was coming, and they started putting things underneath the ground to hide them and protect them until the catastrophe was over. And this kind of goes hand in hand with some of the stuff, like the Osiris tomb. There was one tomb found on Giza. It was Queen, oh boy, some of these names I have a hard time pronouncing. I can't remember the queen's last name, Hephaestus or something like that. Anyway, Reisner found the tomb back in the late 20s or early 30s, and the tomb was untouched. So he had this big celebration of the opening of this tomb and had all these dignitaries come in. Anyway, these 10 people got down to the tomb, and when they opened the sarcophagus, it was empty. And it was sealed, too. So that was very, very strange. But the important part is what the other things were in the room. There was all kinds of furnishings and implements that were placed in that room. And Reisner wrote that these artifacts were so wonderful and so beautiful that we today would have a hard time duplicating their quality.
Are you talking about now scientific tools, or what kind of artifacts were described?
Household stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Chairs, beds, furniture. I believe there were some personal effects. But the black.
Well, you know, Ed, bottom line is we tend to think of ourselves, and this is scary, as the ultimately evolved civilization of humankind.
Well, and I don't believe that for a minute.
What I mean as far as technology, because when we talk about history and say, and they had things that were even more sophisticated than ours, as if, you know, we've reached some kind of level of high-tech wizardry. And in fact, we have in many ways. But that is not to say that there have not been thousands of civilizations before us that have reached an apex and declined, reached an apex and declined.
Have you ever heard of a book called The Mystery of the Cathedrals?
I heard about it in your book, and I made a note to try to find it, but I have a feeling this is going to be one of those books that you can't get your hands on anymore.
No. It's being reprinted. I bought one new. You should be able to find it if you go to Amazon or some other website and do a search on it. But the introduction to Mystery of the Cathedrals, which was written back in the 20s by Falconelli, the mysterious figure Falconelli, no one really knows who he was. Some think he was actually Schwaller himself, but no one really knows. The introduction, I think a guy's name was Glenn Wong, wrote the introduction for it. He says that the secret tradition of the alchemists says that humankind has had 40 different civilizations that have come and gone, and we're the first.
There you go.
So, you know, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
We're the 41st?
We're the 41st.
That's very interesting, considering there were 42 tribes in the land of the Kemetians.
Yes, that's right.
I'm a numerologist, so I take nothing for granted when it comes to number and geometry. Well, that's really fascinating. So we have deflected completely from so many things that I was going to ask you that I've got to ask you right now. Are you going to come back on my show and give us the second half? Because there are so many more questions that I don't think we can cover tonight.
No, I'd love to.
Okay, great. Then I'll keep going in this direction. All right, so we're back sneaking around on the Giza Plateau, and I'm surprised that you haven't been able to get into the subterranean chamber because when I bring groups there, I ask for private access. It's a bit tricky. You have to pay for it. And I get my groups in there for 2 hours, and they never allow the subterranean chamber, but they always do for me.
Wow.
Which means that people can either come up to the top where we do the most incredible, like many other groups, we do a lot of toning, and incredible things go on with sound, including Tibetan masters coming through in the sound. Everyone can hear them. You know that?
That's pretty neat, yeah.
The last time we were there, because I've always heard them, but the last time we were there, everyone, without my ever mentioning it, I don't ever use that subjective planting of ideas, people started to say as we were coming out, I heard Tibetan masters chanting. I mean, how could you miss them? They were seriously loud in there. I have my own theories about how the Tibetan masters know how to travel on sound. And it's like the Great Pyramid, it seems to be just the epicentral sound chamber on this planet.
Yes, it is.
I really agree with everything you've said about that, and it's pretty exciting. And in the subterranean chamber, you've just got to get in there.
I know I do.
Because I can't describe it. I get speechless when I think about it, having had two or three life-altering experiences down there. But one thing I would like you to know is that when I had a group in, they were chanting down there, they were chanting in the Queen's Chamber, and they were chanting in the King's Chamber, and many of us could feel in whatever altered consciousness we were in that the walls were starting to breathe.
Wow.
The granite was starting to move, and people did comment about the fact that we were leaning up against the walls and it felt like we were going to go right through them.
Wow.
So
awesome.
I said, hey, here's where the the Great Pyramid just takes off. You know, but you've got to get down there and experiment with this because it's just a remarkable, remarkable thing to do.
I certainly want to. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I can help you do that if you'd like. I volunteer to make that happen for you. Right, so we talked about the Ice Age back when we were talking about 10,005 and BC and whatever the calamity was. And this does lead me into asking you how you perceive what's happening now. Because we've got this perpetual conversation and debate about Earth changes, and a lot of people are in a lot of fear about this. And I'd love to have your perspective on current global shifts, how you perceive them, and what's your take on this?
Well, first off, I don't have any fears, okay?
Any fears?
I have no fears about what's going on right now.
Yeah, I have no fears, too.
And really, there's kind of two different things going on. There's a spiritual thing going on, and there's an actual physical thing going on.
And they're the same anyway, aren't they?
They could be. I'm not 100% sure if they are the exact same thing. This gets into
well, but
cycles.
You're a quantum physicist,
right? Yeah, it's. Oh, this is deep stuff. This is really, really, really deep stuff. But physically, what's going on is the planet is warming up. There's really no doubt about that.
Right.
Is man the culprit? I don't think so. There's a fascinating book out. And this guy had a hard time trying to get it published because it's not the standard global warming blame man type of book. He's a physicist, by the way. I love physicists. You can tell I love physicists.
Yes, so do I.
Anyway,
what's
his
name?
Pardon?
What's his name?
Oh boy, his book is called The Chilling Stars. He's a Swedish man.
Okay, well, we can just tell people that the book is called The Chilling Stars. They can look it up at the end of the show.
Yeah, it's called The Chilling Stars. And through his work, he has discovered that there is a very high correlation between the temperature of the planet and where we are in relation to our orbit around the galactic core. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that if we are, as we move through the galaxy, if there are a lot of stars nearby us, okay, this creates excess cosmic rays. And these excess cosmic rays, as they come through our atmosphere, they react with dust particles and create low-level clouds. So, the more cloud cover we have at low levels, the cooler the planet will be. And the less cosmic rays that come through, the less clouds we'll have. So, less clouds, we have a warming of the planet. More clouds, we have a cooling of the planet. And this cycle, you know, goes up and down over a wide term. It's, I don't know, 100,000 years, 200,000 years. It all depends on our position, where we are in the galaxy. And right now, in the past 10,000 years, our planet has moved out of and away from Orion's arm. So our planet is in an area where there's not a whole lot of stars around it that are close by to give off these cosmic rays. So that kind of explains the physical part. The spiritual part has to do with science on the one hand, and it has to do with people seeking the truth on the other hand. You can call it New Age if you want. That's a good word for it. But people, just in general, are becoming more spiritual. They are awakening themselves to, you know, the fact that we are all one person. We are all one abstract entity, and we've been fragmented into a physical world, so we can experience. And this is growing, and
hallelujah, it's about time.
Yeah, and of course there's theories on this too. The yuga theories, you know, they say that there's a cycle to civilization, that we go through dark ages and we get enlightened, and then civilization will crash again, and this will keep going on like this.
Well, this is tying back into what we were saying earlier about the rise and fall of the ancient civilizations, and remembering that because they had a certain technology shouldn't surprise us, really, because to have reached a skill better than ours or more adept than ours in artifact creation, for example, just reminds us that everything rises and falls. You know what? Rising and falling is the time. I'm already at the end of our interview. Can you believe we've been together for an hour?
Oh, my gosh, we have, haven't we?
That was talk about time flying.
Well, time flies.
And we're just off and running here on a subject that we need to spend time on. It's very exciting. So I have to really ask you to come back soon.
I will do that.
Okay, so what we'll do is, as we wrap it up now for the people who are going to be saying, no, keep going, I'll remind you all that my incredible guest tonight is Edward. It's tonight here in Rome. I know it's daytime where you are.
Yeah, it's
Edward Malkowski. Yeah, I make this mistake all the time. Again, we're talking about his wonderful book, The Spiritual Technology of Ancient Egypt. But he's got his other books. You've got to check him out. His site is edwardfmalkowski.com. A truly enlightened seeker of truth and someone that I'm really honored to have shared this hour with. And as soon as we hang up, I'm going to ask Edward to come back, plan to come back. So there will be a part two to this interview, and you'll be able to find out more about that on my website. It's SyrianRevelations.net. Don't forget, Egypt is coming up, and who knows if we might be able to Shanghai Edward and bring him for part of that journey to Egypt. So stay tuned. And thanks again, Edward. It's been a wonderful hour with you. I celebrate all that you do and all that you bring forward.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Good night, everybody. Don't forget, keep your minds open. Lots of people want ownership to your gray matter, and you just keep your heads out way beyond the matrix. Much love. I'll be with you next week. Arrivederci.